whales that were moving along in a colony of gigantic forms. At this point, John Whipple faced a major decision. He knew, for he was a missionary like Abner, that since this was the Sabbath, he was bound not to participate in this desecration of catching whales. But he also knew, as a scientist, that he might never again have a chance of watching a crew fight a great sperm whale. So after a moment's indecision, he handed Abner his tall hat and said, "I'm going up into the rigging." Abner protested, but in vain, and during the ensuing 7 exciting hours, he stood glumly aft and refused steadfastly to look at the whaling operations. Brother Whipple, from his vantage point in the rigging, saw the 3 whaleboats from the Carthaginian, each with sail aloft, a harpooner, a helmsman, and 4 rowers, sweep down upon the massive whales. "They're sperm," Captain Hawksworth exulted. "Look at 'em." And he passed Whipple a telescope. In the glass, John spied the enormous beasts, wallowing in the sea and spouting a mixture of water and compressed air, more than 15 feet into the air. "How many whales are there out there?" Whipple asked. 30, Hawksworth suggested cautiously. "How many will you try to take?" "We'll be lucky if we get 1. Sparm's smart whales." Whipple watched the lead boat try to sneak up on a particularly large monster, but it moved aggravatingly off, so the mate directed his whaleboat onto a substitute, a huge gray-blue sperm that lazed along in the sun. Creeping up to it from the rear and on the right side, the mate maneuvered his prow deftly into the whale's long flank, and the harpooner, poised with left leg extended securely into the bottom of the boat, right cocked precariously against the gunwales, drew the harpoon back in his left hand, and then flashed it with incredible might deep into the whale's resistant body. At this first agonizing moment, the great beast flipped out of the water, the harpoon lines trailing, and Whipple cried, "It's bigger than the Thetis!" For the men of the Carthaginian had hooked into a mammoth whale. "It'll make 80 barrels," a seaman cried. "If we take him," Hawksworth cautioned. Grabbing the glass from Whipple, he watched the manner in which the whale plunged in its first attempt to shake off its tormentors. "He's sounded," the captain reported ominously, waiting to see how the first mad dash of the monster would be handled by the crew. Whipple could see the rope whirring out of the harpooner's tub, with a sailor poised ready with an axe to chop it free, thus losing the whale if trouble developed, and it seemed as if the Leviathan must be probing the very bottom of the ocean, so much rope went out. The minutes passed, and there was no sign of the whale. The other 2 boats placed themselves out of the way, yet ready to assist if the whale surfaced near them. Then, in an unexpected quarter, and not far from the Carthaginian, the whale surfaced. It came roaring up through the waves, twisted, turned, flapped its great flukes, then blew. A tower of red blood spurted high into the air, a monument of bubbling death, and poised there for a moment in the sunlight as if it were a pillar of red marble, falling back at last into the sea to make the waves crimson. 4 more times the huge beast spouted its lungs' burden of blood. Hawksworth, noting the color, shouted, "He's well struck." Now came the most tense moment of the fight, for the anguished whale hesitated, and all knew that if it came out of this pause in the wrong direction, it might stove the whaleboats, or crush them in its powerful underslung jaw, or even crash headfirst into the Carthaginian herself, sinking her within minutes, in the way many whalers had been lost. This time, the whale ran true, and at a speed of 30 miles an hour, rushed through the open ocean, dragging the whaleboat along behind. Now the sail was furled, and the 4 rowers sat with their oars aloft, while their mates aboard the Carthaginian shouted, "There goes the Nantucket sleigh ride." In this way, 6 men in a little rowboat fought an enormous whale to death. The beast dived and paused, spouted blood, and dived again. It ran for the open sea and doubled back, but the harpoon worked deeper into its flank, and the rope remained taut. When the whale moved close to the boat, the oarsmen worked feverishly hauling in rope. But when the beast fled, they played it out again. And in this wild red game of take in and play out, the whale began to sense that it would be the loser. Now a second whaleboat crept in, and its harpooner launched another cruel shaft of iron deep into the whale's forward quarter. And the chase was on again, this time with two whaleboats on the sleigh ride. Swiftly they were hauled through the bloody sea, and swiftly their ropes were brought close in when the whale rested. Back and forth, up and down, the Leviathan fought, blood choking his lungs and beginning to paralyze his flukes. "He's a monster, that one," Captain Hawksworth said approvingly. "Pray God he doesn't catch one of the boats." The minutes passed, and then the quarter hours, and the whale fought on, bleeding profusely and seeking the safer depths. But always he had to surface, a great bull sperm whale in agony. Until finally, after a last mighty surge through the red waves, he rolled over and was dead. "Got him," Captain Hawksworth shouted, as the third whaleboat moved in to attach its line to the second. And in this manner, the three crews slowly began to tow the whale back to their mother ship. The Carthaginian, meanwhile, manipulated its sails so that it could move with equal caution toward the oncoming whale. Aboard ship, there was much activity. Along the starboard side, a section of railing was lifted away, and a small platform was lowered 6 or 8 feet above the surface of the sea. Men brought out razor-sharp blubber knives with 20-foot handles. Others laboriously lugged huge iron hooks, each weighing almost as much as a man, into position for biting into the blubber and pulling it aboard. Where Abner was to have preached, the cook and his helper piled dry wood for firing the tripods in which the whale oil would be rendered, while forward, the scar-faced cooper supervised the opening of the hatch and the airing of barrels into which that blubber would be stowed that could not be immediately cooked. Just as these preparations were completed, with John Whipple noting each step in the process, and Abner Hale trying not to do so because all was being done on a Sunday, the whale was brought alongside, and Whipple cried, "It's longer than the Thetis." But Captain Hawksworth, who like all whalers never referred to the length of a whale, growled, "He'll make 80, 90 barrels, a monster." When the great sperm was lashed to the starboard side of the Carthaginian, and when the frail platform was adjusted, a black Brava sailor from the Cape Verdes nimbly leaped onto the whale's body, and with a slashing knife tried to cut at the blubber so as to attach the giant hooks that were being lowered to him. Deft as he was, he could not make the enormous hooks fast, and when the Carthaginian took a sudden shift to windward, the Brava was struck in the chest by one of the swaying hooks and swept off the whale's flank and into the ocean, whereupon a dozen sleek sharks who had been following the blood stormed down upon him. But the men on the platform slashed and cut at the raiders and drove them off, so that the Brava climbed back on the whale, cursing in Portuguese, and this time, dripping in blood from whale and shark alike, he caught the brutal hooks into the blubber, and the unwinding was ready to begin. But before it could start, the whale's great head, 26 feet long and weighing tons, had to be cut away and fastened to the after end of the ship. "You, Brava," Captain Hawksworth shouted, "tie this hook into the head." And the sinewy black man leaped nimbly onto the whale's head, securing the hook, after which his mates, with extra sharp knives on long poles, sawed away the mammoth head. When it drifted clear, they directed their knives to the body of the whale, slashing the thick, blubbery skin in sloping spirals that started from where the head had been and ran down to the huge tail hanging limp in the sea. As the skilled workmen cut, they frequently paused for sport and slashed their deadly knives deep into some shark that had come to feed upon the carcass. And when the knife was withdrawn, the shark would twist slightly as if a bee had stung him and continue feeding. Now, the men on the lines leading to heavy hooks began to haul, and slowly the whale rolled over and over upon itself, while the blanket of blubber unpeeled in a huge spiral and was hauled aloft. When more than a dozen feet hung over the deck, one iron hook was cut free from the top and hooked into position lower down. Then the other was cut away and fastened beside the first, allowing the end of blubber to fall free upon the deck, where it was cut away, hacked into pieces, and thrust at first into the boiling trypots, and when they were full, into the temporary barrels. Then the lines were hauled tight once more, and the thick blanket of blubber continued to unwind and swing aboard, as men on the swaying platform cut it free from the body of the slowly revolving whale. At last the tail was reached, and in the final moments, before the monstrous carcass was set free for the sharks, the Brava leaped back onto it and cut away a dozen steaks of fresh whale meat. "Get some liver, too," a sailor shouted. But the Brava felt himself slipping toward the sharks, so he grabbed a line and swung himself back aboard the platform. With a final slash of their scimitar-like knives, the workmen cut the whale loose, and he drifted away to the waiting sharks. Next, the giant head was cut into three sections and hauled aboard, where near-naked men scooped out of its vast case more than 24 precious barrels full of spermaceti, which would be converted into candles and cosmetics. At dusk, when the head sections, now empty of their treasure, had been dumped back into the sea where 12 hours before they had held a tiny brain which had steered the Goliath through the waves, Captain Huxworth shouted, "Through the generosity of the Lord, our prayers have been delayed. Let the tripods tend themselves. We'll pray." And he assembled all hands onto the oily deck. But Abner Hale would not participate in the services, so John Whipple conducted both the prayers and the singing, and delivered an inspired sermon on a passage from the 104th Psalm. "O Lord, how manifold are thy works! The earth is full of thy riches. So is this great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beasts. There go the ships, there is that Leviathan whom thou hast made to play therein. The glory of the Lord shall endure forever." In his peroration he preached quietly, "From the turbulent deep God has raised up Leviathan. From the wastes of the ocean he has brought us his riches. But from the wastes of the human ocean, constantly he provides us with riches greater still. For the Leviathan of man's spirit is immeasurable, and its wealth is counted not in casks or spermaceti. It is counted in love and decency and faith. May we who have trapped the great whale trap in our own lives the greater Leviathan of understanding." Captain Huxworth was visibly moved by Whipple's sermon and shouted, "Cook, break out some good food and we'll celebrate." "We ought to be getting back to the Thetis," Abner warned. "Forget the Thetis," Huxworth boomed. "We'll sleep here tonight." And he led the missionaries down into his quarters, and they were stunned. The cabin was spacious, with clean green cloth upon the table. The captain's retiring room was finished in fine mahogany and decorated with numerous examples of carved whalebone, while his sleeping quarters featured a commodious bed, furnished with clean linen and hung on gimbals, so that even though the Carthaginian rolled in a storm, its captain slept in a steady bed. Along the wall was slung a bookcase, filled with works on geography, history, the oceans, and poetry. Compared to the mean and meager Thetis, this ship was luxurious. And the food was good. Captain Huxworth said in a low, strong voice that carried his magnetism through the cabin, "We fight hard for our whales. We never finish second best, and we eat well. This is a lucky ship. And Reverend Whipple, at the conclusion of this voyage, I'll own 2/3 of her, and at the end of the next, she'll be mine." "These are fine quarters," Whipple replied. "I had the mahogany put in at Manila. You see, I'm bringing my wife aboard on the next trip." He laughed apologetically and explained, "When a captain does that, the crew calls the ship a hen frigate. Some whalers won't ship aboard a hen frigate. Others prefer it. Say, the food and the medicine are apt to be better. Do captains' wives ever get seasick? Whipple asked. A little, at first, Toxworth boomed. But on a bigger ship like this, they get over it quickly. I'd like to see Amanda and Jerusha as captains' wives, Whipple laughed. Did you say Jerusha? The captain asked. Yes, Jerusha Hale, Abner's wife. Excellent, the big man cried. It's Jerusha I'm marrying, too. And he reached out to grab Abner's small hand. Where's yours from, Reverend Hale? Walpole, New Hampshire, Abner replied, unhappy at mentioning his wife's name in a whaling cabin. Did you say Walpole? Hawksworth asked. Yes. Big Rafer Hawksworth kicked back his chair and grabbed Abner by the coat. Is Jerusha Bromley aboard that brig out there? He asked menacingly. Yes, Abner replied steadily. God Almighty, Hawksworth cried, shoving Abner back into his chair. Anderson, lower me a boat. With fury clouding his face, he grabbed his cap, jammed it on the back of his head, and stormed aloft. When Abner and John tried to follow, he thrust them back into the cabin. You wait here, he thundered. Mr. Wilson, he bellowed at his mate, if these men try to leave this cabin, shoot 'em. And in a moment he was on the sea, driving his men toward the brig Thetis. When he swung himself aboard, refusing to wait for a ladder, Captain Janders asked, Where are the missionaries? But Hawksworth, dark as the night, roared, To hell with the missionaries, where's Jerusha Bromley? And he stormed down into the smelly cabin, shouting, Jerusha! Jerusha! When he found her sitting at the table, he swept all the other missionaries together with his giant arms and roared, Get out of here! And when they were gone, he took Jerusha's hands and asked, Is what they tell me true? Jerusha, with an extra radiance, now that she was both recovered from seasickness and in the first happy flush of pregnancy, drew back from the dynamic man who had wooed her 4 years ago. Hawksworth, seeing this, slammed his powerful fist onto the table and shouted, Almighty God, what have you done? I have gotten married, Jerusha said firmly and without panic. To that worm, to that miserable little... To a wonderfully understanding man, she said, drawing herself against a small section of the wall that separated two stateroom doors. That goddamned puny... Rafer, don't blaspheme. I'll blaspheme this whole goddamn stinking little ship to hell before I'll let you... Rafer, you stayed away. You never said you would marry me. Never said, he roared, leaping over a fallen chair to grab her to him. I wrote to you from Canton. I wrote to you from Oregon. I wrote from Honolulu. I told you that as soon as I landed in New Bedford, we'd be married and that you'd sail with me on my ship. It'll be my ship soon, Jerusha, and you're sailing with me. Rafer, I'm married. To a minister. Your letters never came. You can't be married, he stormed. It's me you love, and you know it. He crushed her to him and kissed her many times. I can't let you go. Rafer, she said quietly, pushing him away, you must respect my condition. The big captain fell back and looked at the girl he had been dreaming of for nearly 4 years. It is true that he had not, on that first wild acquaintance, asked her to marry him. But when the whales were good and his future known, he had written to her 3 separate times, cautious lest any one letter not be delivered. Now she said that she was married, perhaps even pregnant, to a contemptible little worm with scraggly hair. I'll kill you first, he screamed. By God, Jerusha, you shall never remain married. And he lunged at her with a chair. Abner, she cried desperately, not knowing that he was absent, for she was certain that if he were aboard the Thetis, somehow he would rescue her. Abner! The chair crashed by her head, and the wild sea captain was upon her. But before she fainted, she saw Keoki and the old whaler leaping down into the cabin with hooks and clubs. Later, the missionaries comforted her, saying, We heard it all, Sister Hale, and we hoped not to intervene, for he was a madman, and we trusted he would recover his senses. I had to club him, Mrs. Hale, Keoki apologized. Where is he now? Captain Janders is taking him back to his ship, one of the wives explained. But where is Reverend Hale? Jerusha cried in deep love and fear. He's on the other ship, Keoki explained. Captain Huxworth will kill him, Jerusha wailed, trying to get onto the deck. That's why Captain Janders went along, Keoki assured her, with pistols. But not even Captain Janders was able to protect Abner that night, for although Rafer Huxworth quieted down on the cooling trip to the Carthaginian, and although he was a model of politeness to John Whipple, when he saw Abner, and how small he was, and how wormy in manner, he lost control and leaped screaming at the little missionary, lifting him from the deck and rushing him to the railing of the ship where the blubber had been taken aboard. And possibly because he slipped unexpectedly on grease, or possibly by intention, he raised Abner high into the night and flung him furiously into the dark waves. "You'll not keep her," he screamed insanely. "I'll come back to Honolulu and rip her from your arms. By God, I'll kill you, you miserable little worm." While he was shouting, Captain Janders was desperately maneuvering his rowboat, warning his men, "After they cut a whale, there's bound to be sharks." And the rowers saw dark forms gliding in the water, and one brushed Abner so that he screamed with fear, "Sharks!" From the dark deck of the Carthaginian, Captain Huxworth roared, "Get him, sharks, get him. He's over on this side. Here he is, sharks." And he was raging thus when John Whipple reached into the vast Pacific and pulled his brother aboard. "Did the sharks get you, Abner?" he whispered. "They took my foot." "No, it's all right, Abner. A little blood, that's all."
"You mean my foot isn't..."
"It's all right, Abner," Whipple insisted.
"But I felt a shark."
"Yes, one hit at you," Whipple said reassuringly, "but it only scraped the skin. See, these are your toes." And the last thing Abner could remember before he fainted was John Whipple pinching his toes, and from a dark distance Rafer Huxworth screaming futilely, "Get him, sharks. He's over there. Get the stinking little bastard and chew him up, because if you don't kill him, I'll have to." That was the reason why Abner Hale, 22 years old and dressed in solemn black, with a beaver hat nearly as tall as he was, limped as he prepared to land at the port city of Lahaina, on the island of Maui in Hawaii. The shark had not taken his foot, nor even his toes, but it had exposed the tendon and damaged it, and not even careful John Whipple could completely repair it. The actual landing of the missionaries was a confused affair, for when the Thetis drew into the famous wintering port of Lahaina, there was great commotion on shore, and the missionaries saw with horror that many handsome young women were throwing off their clothes and beginning to swim eagerly toward the little brig, which apparently they knew favorably from the past. But the attention of the ministers was quickly diverted from the swimmers to a fine canoe, which, even though it started late, soon overtook the naked swimmers and drew up alongside the Thetis. It contained a man, a completely nude woman, and four attractive girls, equally nude. "We come back," the man cried happily, boosting his women onto the little ship.
"No, no," Keoki Kanakoa cried.